The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day two of this five-day sesshin in January 2015 here at Hidden Valley Zen Center. And we will continue sharing Morinaga Soko Roshi's story about his early years in practice. As you heard yesterday, Morinaga Soko Roshi was a contemporary Zen master. He died, I think it was in 1997, of cancer. And he was a Japanese Zen master in the lineage of Byoanji, one of the headquarter temples of the Rinzai sect in Japan. And he was abbot of Daishuin and left one Dharma successor, who is the abbot of Daishuin West at this point, I believe. At any rate, you remember that he was in high school when the Second World War was in full force, and actually it was in the later years of the war, and Japan was having to recruit younger and younger people in the war effort, and although he was only in high school, the orders came down that anybody who was in high school not in the sciences was drafted. And so suddenly, from one day to the next, he was made deeply aware of his impending death, because what they were drafting these young men for was as kamikaze pilots. And a kamikaze pilot, if you remember right, was a pilot who had a one-way out fuel level in his tank because he was not expected to come back in. He was expected to go out, find an enemy ship, and dive bomb it, turning his plane and himself into a weapon of war. This was a little bit of a shock to these young high school kids, but the propaganda at the time was that it was a just war, that Japan was marching out to throw off the cloak of imperialism and save Southeast Asia. After the war, the other side of the story was told, and it was a shock to the Japanese, that their emperor had taken them into a very aggressive, brutal war. And it hadn't been at all as it was put forth to be. So he survived. He didn't end up going out on a mission, and came home to discover that his parents were both dead. Actually, they died just before he was called up in quick succession. And then when he returned, and there was the American occupation of Japan, and the rules were changed, suddenly the family land was gone, and the insurance money that would have helped support him, and I think he had a sister, at least one sister, after their parents' death, was tied up in frozen bank assets. So suddenly, he went from being a regular high school philosophy student to virtually homeless. And he wandered the streets, aghast at the change of fortune, and finally decided he would best take himself into a Zen monastery, and that's what he did. Went around to several of them and was not accepted, and finally one elderly abbot, retired abbot, accepted him to his small temple. And his first job was to sweep the garden with a broom made out of twigs with a bamboo handle. And he, unfamiliar with manual labor, swept mightily and got quite a pile of stones and bits and pieces of moss that had been raked up in his enthusiasm and leaves and so on. And he asked the Roshi where to put the trash. And the Roshi famously bellowed, "In people and in things, there is no trash. In people and in things, there is no trash." And then the Roshi got down on his knees and hands and sorted through this pile of what the young monk-to-be called trash, and succeeded in taking care of every last little bit of it in a helpful and useful way. None of it, it turns out, was trash. And it was a big lesson for the young man. And things and then people, there is no trash, there is no rubbish. This was a fundamental, still is a fundamental teaching of Buddhism. And let me take up Morinaga Soko Roshi's words on this. The Roshi's words that originally there is no rubbish either in men or in things actually comprise the basic truth of Buddhism. According to traditional accounts, the Buddha taught, "How marvelous, how wonderful. All sentient beings are perfect and without flaw. It is only due to delusive attachments that the truth cannot be seen." And until the truth is seen, we don't necessarily act as if we're perfect. And even afterwards, depending on how deeply we see that truth, we still have this mountain of habit patterns of greed, anger, and delusion to work through to be able to live in each moment that truth, that fundamental truth of humanity. It's a misunderstanding that Kensho will clear everything away. From then on, we'll be home free. It was an early assumption, and I don't know that it's really been counteracted much, although many, many years ago, decades ago, centuries ago, actually, Hakuin's top student, first Dharma heir, Tore Enji, whose vow for awakening we chant in the morning during chanting services, had it figured out that there is what's called the long maturation, in his words. And that is all the work we need to do to bring our speech, thought, and action into line with the realization that we open to in a Kensho experience. And usually it takes more than one Kensho experience to get deeply enough. But a single one is important because it's a watershed. As Kala Rinpoche said, the eminent, now deceased Tibetan master once said, it's like a flash of lightning in a dark night. It is as if you're on a mountain trail and you're feeling your way along over the rocks and past the edges of cliffs, and suddenly there's a flash of lightning in that middle of the night darkness, and all of a sudden you can see the path ahead. Briefly, but you can see the path ahead. And finally you have a sense, a much clearer sense of the direction you need to go in. And that's basically what Kensho does. And it's very important to understand that we don't consider a single or two or three or even more Kensho experiences the end of our practice. Hakuin himself spoke of having 19 major Kensho experiences and countless minor insights. And that is a model to emulate. We are here on this earth. We have taken birth, in essence, to find out who we really are, to know the truth once and for all, to comprehend our innate perfection and let go the lifetimes of habit patterns of greed, anger, and delusion that impede our experience and manifestation of that innate perfection. In people and in trash, in people and in things, there is no trash. In people and in things, there is no trash. This is something to keep in mind. And Morinaga Sokoro, she's teacher, expressed these in many, many different ways in his teaching. To continue with his words, with words of Morinaga Soko. In another version, he, meaning the Buddha, also said, "I attained the way simultaneously with the whole world and with all sentient beings. Everything, mountains, rivers, trees, and grasses, all attained Buddhahood. At the moment when the fog clouding his own eyes cleared, the enlightened one's voice rang out. I believed that all things in this world lived in the wretched condition of suffering. But now I see that all things are Buddha and are without the slightest flaw. Not only those blessed with a healthy body, but those who cannot see or who have lost their hands or who are lame, they too are perfect just the way they are." So from the very beginning, Zuigan Roshi pointed out for me the root of the great matter, though I was too dull-witted to understand. Gradually I realized that trusting, because the Roshi made his entering the temple there a condition of trusting the Roshi, and that he couldn't do so. He couldn't enter the temple under Zuigan Roshi if he didn't trust the Roshi. Gradually I realized that trusting meant to trust without a murmur of dissent. I must say yes, yes, to everything I was told. Therefore, even when told to do three things or at once or to do something I'd never done before, I could never say, I was never to say, I can't do it or I don't know how to do it. Rather, it was up to me to find out how to accomplish whatever I was given to do, taxing my resources and ingenuity to the utmost. The Roshi's words to me about trusting one's master also meant working it out for myself without complaint. In a Japanese monastery, no matter what you are told to do, literally you simply say "hai," which means yes, without question. Someone at Sogenji once told me that it's okay to say, "I'm sorry, I don't know how to do this." And I mentioned this to Harada Roshi. He said, "Absolutely not. The only way to respond to request is "hai." Yes, and then to go do it. It's a very important training tool, really, especially for Westerners. We Westerners have all our ideas about what we want, what we don't want, what we like and what we don't like, and we don't realize that that's what's causing us pain and suffering. It's not about becoming Pollyanna, cheerful about everything, perhaps falsely so. It's about looking within ourselves to find out what is this caught place that has to say no, or I don't want to do it, or I don't like this, or I don't like that person. If we're all perfect, whole, and complete, what is it? This is not about blindly looking at everybody and not acknowledging things that are inappropriately done. But when we also judge the person, we're setting ourselves and many other people up for pain. In people and in things, there is no trash. It's a hard one. And yet I think of Jacques Le Seran in Buchenwald, surrounded by people who were desperate, in some cases insane, in many cases sadistic, where death was all around. At any moment, you could be singled out one way or another. He spoke of a guard who used to go around throttling people, killing them with his own hands. And one day, his body was found with a knife in the back. And yet, in the middle of that environment, Jacques Le Seran had such a profound awakening experience that right there in the middle of it, he found joy. And suddenly people were treating him very differently, which is something to take a look at. To continue. During the first day, I was also told to wipe the wooden corridors. In Japan, these temples have long wooden, in some cases, corridors, but they're usually on the outsides of the building, not so much inside. And there's a way of cleaning them by taking a damp rag, and it has to be exactly the right level of dampness, or otherwise it doesn't work. And you spread it out and put your hands on it and stick your tail up in the air and run along the floorboards, wiping this rag across the floorboards. And the floorboards go lengthwise, so it makes sense. You're wiping with the grain of the wood. And these floorboards, having been treated that way for decades and centuries in many cases, are beautifully polished. They have no other finish on them except for this daily cleaning with the rag. So that was the first thing he was asked to do after the garden sweeping. Since I duly got down on my hands and knees, cloth in hand, and swished left to right, but the corridors in a temple are different from those of ordinary houses. Idiot! The Roshi shouted. How many days do you think you're going to spend doing that? I'll show you how it's done. And then I saw the 72-year-old master speeding along on all fours, cloth pressed on the floor with his hands, bottom thrust in the air. At that sight, scales dropped from my eyes. I had known nothing but theorizing during my high school days. I often spent the whole night with friends reading books on philosophy and arguing, talk, talk, talk. I now burned with shame because I couldn't even do such a simple job as cleaning a floor properly. These days, too, when bright young people from first-rate universities come to my temple to practice Zazen, the first task I assign them is heating the bath. But the fire has been lit under an empty bathtub so many times that I now query beforehand. And the bathtubs, the traditional bathtubs in Japan, are wooden, as apparently was the one at Daishuin. Nowadays, the modern ones are stainless steel or fiberglass, as in the case of Sogenji. But the fire has been lit under an empty bathtub so many times that I now query beforehand, what's the first thing you do when you heat a bath? Light the fire, they reply. Jolly well not, I say. Fill it with water, they then reply. So I explain that first they should clean the tub, then fill it with water, then check the water level, then cover the top of the tub with the wooden lid, and only then kindle the fire underneath. But when I go to check how they're getting on, I find one or two large logs and lots of burnt newspaper. That won't burn. Use some kindling. But there isn't any kindling, they reply. Then chop some. I don't know where the hatchet is. Well, why don't you ask someone? And finally they set about splitting kindling. However, as I half expect, the fire still does not burn properly. Peering inside, I find they've not removed the old ashes. So I ask again, what makes a fire burn? And the reply comes back, a chemical combination of matter and oxygen. Well, if that's the case, why don't you remove these ashes and let some air in? And while you're at it, you'd better clean the chimney too. And they duly climb onto the roof to clean the bathhouse chimney, and on their way down, as sure as not, they chip a few roof tiles. However, I cannot laugh at these young people, because when I first came to Daishuin, I was just like them. Though I continued pretending outwardly to be a disciple who trusted his master, in my heart I criticized him and rebelled against him. In fact, many of the things he said made me seethe with anger, such as his comments to his attendant during tea sessions. In a small Zen temple like Daishuin, the breakfast of rice gruel is followed by formal tea served in the Roshi's room. After the Roshi's been served, the others also have tea while listening to his plans for the day. When I first came to Daishuin, an old lady named Miss Okamoto also lived there. She was a graduate of the well-known Osha no Mizu Ladies College, and for many years had been involved with women's education. Osha no Mizu. Water for Tea, Ladies College. It says something about what they were being taught. In her 40s, she had become deeply devoted to Buddhism and to the Roshi. She gave up her teaching appointment to spend the rest of her life taking care of his personal needs. And at the time, just the three of us lived in the temple together. The Roshi used to talk to Miss Okamoto, but he never said a word to me. And one morning, probably taking pity on me, she said, "And what do you think, Morinaga?" She was trying to draw me into the conversation, but before I could reply, the Roshi said, "No, no. He's not yet fit to talk in front of people." From the Roshi standpoint, you had first to know yourself before you're qualified to talk in the company of others. In Zen terms, this knowing yourself is called Kensho, which means to have clearly seen and verified one's true nature. And since I had not done so, I was not to speak. And then he talks about the lineage, the immediate lineage of Goto Zuigan Roshi. And this is because he came up in conversation one day in the tea. And says, "One morning at formal tea, Miss Okamoto asked Zuigan Roshi, 'Roshi, who is greater, Kosen Roshi or his heir Soen Roshi?' Imakita Kosen was Goto Zuigan's great-grandfather in Zen. And Soen Roshi was actually Shaku Soen, who was the first Japanese monk, the first Buddhist monk, I believe, to come to the United States and gave a talk at the World Parliament of Religions in the late 1800s in Chicago. He also trained for a while at Sogenji, and there is a scroll that he did the writing of at Sogenji still, along with several scrolls of Hakuin, because Hakuin was the teacher of the folks that actually established Sogenji and used to travel there and teach them. So, who was greater, Kosen Roshi or his heir Soen Roshi? And Zuigan Roshi was a very solemn man, not likely to make jokes, and he replied soberly, "Master Kosen was greater." That was the teacher of Shaku Soen. Miss Okamoto then asked who was greater, Soen Roshi or his heir Sokatsu Roshi. Sokatsu Roshi had no desire to become head abbot of a famous monastery, and after receiving Inca, he settled in a small Tokyo temple and accepted lay people for training. Zuigan Roshi replied, "Master Soen was greater." When Miss Okamoto heard this, she said, "But Roshi, doesn't that mean that the lineage is getting weaker?" Well then, who is greater, your teacher, Sokatsu Roshi, or you? And in a flash, the reply came back, I am greater. When Zuigan Roshi replied in dead earnest that he was greater than his own teacher, Miss Okamoto was greatly pleased. But when I heard her ask, Roshi, who is now greater, you or your disciple, Sesso, I almost burst out laughing. And here he is caught in a predetermined assumption about somebody based on not knowing them, but just based on their outward appearance. At that time, Zuigan Roshi had reached the pinnacle of the Zen world, having been successively head abbot of Myoshinji and Daitokuji, both of those headquarter temples, the Rinzai sect, whereas Sesso, without any position as yet, was caretaker of a small sub-temple within the grounds of Myoshinji. Since I had no insight into a man's true nature, but judged people solely by their social standing, I could not help thinking how absurd it was to try to compare Sesso with Zuigan Roshi. And I tried hard to contain my laughter. But without a moment's reflection, Zuigan Roshi said, it is not yet known. It is not yet known. So he was open to the possibility that his student would be greater than he. This is not a high ego position. At those words, the laughter suddenly died in me and tears welled up in my eyes. I realized what a splendid teacher I had, although he would invariably take the hard line and say, that fellow's not fit to talk in front of people. Zuigan Roshi also bore in mind his disciple's future development. He took into account not just the disciple's present immature form, but also the form he was confident that the disciple would have after 1, 2, 10, or 20 years of training. This was the implication of his words, it is not yet known, which struck me so forcibly. And a teacher does see the perfection of the student, even when the student can't see it themselves. At Kaplan Roshi's 90th birthday celebration, his Dharma successors were asked to say 3 things about him. And one of the things that I said was, Roshi, you believed in me when I couldn't believe in myself. Another thing I said was, I saw that even though you may have had some habit patterns of behavior that were challenging, as soon as you saw it, it was done. He could turn on a dime in his own training like that, as soon as he saw where he was being dysfunctional. That behavior stopped, even mid-sentence. This was a man who truly, truly was a Zen master. He never quit working on himself. And he always believed in his students. A teacher will possibly say some things that are strong to a student. But have faith that the teacher sees that innate perfection even before the student can see it, himself or herself. Indeed, almost as though confirming his words, Sesso later succeeded Zuigan as head abbot of Daitokuji. I also trained under Sesso Roshi, and he was the equal of his teacher in every way. From that moment, I began to feel a deep trust in my teacher, but I still lacked even the slightest understanding. At one point in my training, I did something wrong, and Master Zuigan, in accord with custom, ordered me to leave Daishuin. When I went to ask forgiveness and permission to stay, prostrating myself with my head to the ground in a quiet manner, he did not relent. No matter how many times I begged to be allowed to remain his disciple, he countered with a firm no. Finally, in real despair, I lifted my head from the floor and looked up at the Roshi. When I saw his stern look, a lump rose in my throat. I just stared back at him and out of the very depths of my being stated, "Whatever happens, whatever you say, however you try to throw me out, I'll never leave your side, never, never." Thus, eye to eye with the Roshi, I saw tears form in his eyes, slowly well over and flow down his cheeks. I was moved to the core by my heart, core of my heart, by the bond that I felt with him. I knew that I was truly his disciple for life, and I also knew that he knew it, and that he was glad to have such a disciple. Relationship between master and disciple must be so close and so strong that not even a single hair can be inserted between them. It might be compared with sumo wrestlers in the ring. Huge men weighing over 350 pounds can crash into their opponents with all their might only because they have absolute confidence that the ring in which they fight will not give way beneath them. In Zen training, the I must at all costs be broken. That's a rather strong way to put it. We don't try to break the self-image. We go deeply within ourselves to search for the truth of who we are. And in the process of that, we begin to see through the self-image. So it's not about breaking it. It's about seeing through it. Seeing it for the imposter that it is. But this tenacious I cannot be conquered in a timid fashion. Nothing will come of the training unless you dig in your heels and hang on despite being scolded, struck, or threatened with expulsion. Now you get a taste of what it's like to train in a Zen monastery in Japan. I'd spent more than a year at Daishuin when the Roshi said to me, "People, especially novice monks, should not live alone. You need to come into contact with many people. Practicing as the only disciple under a teacher is fine, but now you should enter a monastery to interact with others." My training at Daishuin was considered preliminary, and I was still classed as a novice. Properly to become a Zen monk, I had to enter a monastery. It was decided then that I should be sent to Daitokuji, one of the largest Zen monasteries in Kyoto, less than an hour's walk from Daishuin. Living together in a monastery, we get a big opportunity to face our stuff. Kapla Roshi used to say, it's like we're all rocks in a tumbler. In banging up against each other, we polish ourselves and each other. Any issues we have out in the lay world, we'll bring right with us into the monastery. So it really doesn't matter whether in the monastery or out and about. If we've got stuff to work on, it'll be shown to us sooner or later. And what an incredible opportunity. What an amazing opportunity to be able to work on ourselves, to have the tools to dig through the superficial accretions and open to that innate perfection that we are and allow our innate compassion and wisdom to function more and more completely in everything we do or say or think. This is the real purpose of practice. Liberation, true liberation. And the reason it can be so challenging is because in order to become liberated, we have to see where we're caught. Until we see where we're caught, we can't become free of it. And we don't like seeing where we're caught. It's painful. It's frustrating. We'd rather see instead a different person, someone who's kind and compassionate, wise, understanding, generous, empathic. And by and large, we are these things. But here and there, we've got some habit patterns, each one of us, and I don't leave myself out of this one at all, that maybe we could polish a little bit, work on, give a little less grief to the world. We have this life in which to do this work. And while Buddhism believes in rebirth, we have no guarantees, none whatsoever. The meaning behind the way the han is played with that accelerando, and also the way the inkin bell is played when we're to get up for prostrations with an accelerando, expresses how as we get older and older, life goes by much more quickly. Do we have enough time? It's something to ask ourselves. This work, this vital work of letting go until we open completely enough to that innate perfection that we can live it 100%. Do we have enough time? Are we working hard enough? It's important to take a look and to make the very best of what amounts to really, in terms of a lifetime, just a few moments of being able to practice, so that we can do this vital work of opening to and living 100% our true nature. We have 3 days left in this session, just a little bit more than three, but not much more than three. The most difficult points in Sesshin are basically under our belt at this point. The first 2 days are the most challenging, the most difficult, because we're not so accustomed of doing this much zazen in a day. Not only that, but the power of concentration that we have as a result of doing the work we've done these first 2 days is far greater than it was this morning, yesterday, or before Sesshin started. Take advantage of that and take it even deeper. It will be so worth it. I think this is enough for today. I thank you for listening, and we'll continue tomorrow with Morinaga Soko Roshi's teaching.